Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on Bournemouth, Christchurch, and Poole Council versus Livia Tasichi Bolt. Our moderator today is Professor Maimon Schwarzschild. Professor Schwarzschild is professor of law at the University of San Diego. He's published extensively on constitutional law, jurisprudence, law and religion, and civil rights. He's an English barrister and American lawyer. He was attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice and has practiced as a barrister in London in the 1980s. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Caroline. And welcome, everyone, to the International National Security Law Practice Group. My guest today is Paul Coleman, who is Senior Counsel and Deputy Director of the Alliance Defending Freedom International, at its headquarters in Vienna, actually. So this is a webinar that spans the globe between California, whence I am speaking, to Austria, to Vienna, whence Paul is joining us. Paul specializes in international human rights and European law. He is a solicitor in England and qualified before the senior courts in England. He is a graduate with first-class honors from Newcastle University in England, and he is the author of numerous articles and of two books, including Censored, How European Hate Speech Laws Are Threatening Freedom of Speech. I hope you can all see it here. And it is available where all good online availabilities are available. So it's a great book and an important one on an immensely important and in some ways sinister issue. Welcome, Paul. Topic of the litigation update today is freedom of religion and freedom of expression, freedom of speech. But it has tangible, the cases that we're going to talk about have tangible implications for international and even national security concerns. And these were highlighted not long ago by Vice President Vance, who, as is got a lot of publicity, is well known, addressed the Munich Security Conference in February. And alluded, indeed, cited by name, at least one of the cases that we'll be talking about today. In addressing the Western leaders, Vice President Vance said, the greatest threat to security of the West comes today not from China or Europe or Russia, but from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared, the implication was, until now, with the United States of America. Perhaps most concerningly, said the Vice President, I look to our very dear friends, the United Kingdom, where the backslide away from conscience rights has placed the basic liberties of religious Britons, in particular, in the crosshairs. A State Department source familiar with and involved in the US-UK trade negotiations is reported to have told a major broadsheet newspaper in Britain at the time that there will be, in his words, no free trade without free speech. The Vice President's address in Munich was controversial. It was received with some distress by a lot of the European establishment and European leaders, but it certainly highlighted the questions of freedom of religion and of free expression in Britain and elsewhere. are not at this point questions of human rights alone, but may have global economic and geopolitical implications as well. Vice President Vance referred explicitly to one of two recent court cases in the UK, cases that Paul Coleman and the Alliance for Defending Freedom are closely involved with. The most recent one is a prosecution in the south of England of Livia Tosici Bolt. Paul, what happened in this case?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on to speak about it. So Livia is a retired medical scientist, and she held a sign that simply said the following words: "Here to talk if you want." That's all she said. She stood silently, and she was...
Where was this? Stood silently where?
Yeah, so... she stood silently 150 meters or so from the vicinity of a abortion center in the UK. And she was prosecuted for this and ultimately convicted in the magistrates' court for breaching what is referred to as a public space protection order. So what is that? In 2014, the Conservative government passed a piece of legislation on crime policing, antisocial behavior. And within that, they created broad powers to local authorities to adopt their own PSPOs, public space protection orders. And they were designed so that local administrative councils could regulate behavior at a local level without needing to pass primary legislation in Westminster. And so the Bournemouth Council passed one of these PSPOs that limited otherwise lawful behavior within the vicinity of abortion centers. And these laws were designed to stop what the UK referred to as antisocial behavior. So that is the sort of yobbish behavior of youths who are hanging around on street corners, causing all sorts of trouble and so forth. The way that this PSPO was written, it was deliberately written in a way to target primarily Christian pro-life volunteers who meet to pray, to offer support to those who might be considering an abortion. And so the writing of the PSPO includes restrictions on, for example, praying. It includes restrictions on crossing oneself and genuflecting and sprinkling holy water. I mean, I'm not kidding you. This is the language of the law. Now, Livia was found guilty of breaching this PSPO, which she denies. She refused to pay the fine, and that's why she was prosecuted, and now is considering appealing that decision.
Was she accused of having harassed the clients of the abortion clinic? Was she accused of in any way forcing herself on the abortion clients?
No, but within the wording of some of these exceptionally broadly written laws, you don't have to do as much as a sort of harassment. So the UK already criminalizes harassment. There's an entire act dedicated to it with a pretty strong definition of what that means. These laws go far beyond that. So the Bournemouth law, for example, bans what it refers to as protest. And she would also say that she was not protesting, but it also bans interfering with people who may be considering having an abortion. And then finally, there's a sort of a catch-all provision that says it's an offence not to leave this area when told to do so by the police. So it sort of gives a freestanding blank check to the police that if they tell you to leave for any reason and you refuse to do so, then you're in violation of it. And so it's that sort of catch-all that they're applying in her case, as well as this broad notion of interfering with. And these, just to put it into context, there are a number of councils around the UK that have adopted these public space protection orders around abortion centers. And they have led to a number of different pocketed prosecutions across the country. And then in 2023, the UK passed primary legislation in its Public Order Act that made these buffer zones or censorship zones, as we call them, mandatory around the country. And so now what we're seeing in Bournemouth will happen elsewhere as well.
To be clear, what Livia Tosici-Polk did was not even to address out loud any of the clients of the abortion clinic. She simply held up a sign saying, if you would like to speak, I am here. That was literally all she did.
And she did, I mean, she is trying not to. She's not being a protester, seeing this law and saying, oh, I'm going to run a test case here. She's trying to stay within the confines of the law, but nevertheless offer a consensual conversation to anybody who might pass by.
So she was convicted. What was the penalty that was imposed?
So because these are small administrative laws, that the penalties are low, and in her case, and there's no prison sentences involved in these laws. There's a fine, which she was not fined, but she had to pay significant costs of the prosecution. Now that became the penalty. On the one hand, they said, well, we won't fine you because you're a first time offender and so forth, but we will make you pay the prosecution costs, in this case, over $20,000. And just to put that in context, that is so phenomenally rare for someone to be convicted of a small administrative offense like this and be paying these sorts of sums. And it's quite shocking. And in fact, there's almost no precedent for this sort of prosecution costs being put on the person who's being convicted, which would normally be picked up by the taxpayer.
The £20,000, wasn't it?
Yes.
And to put that in context, that's something like 6 months' wage at the average wage of a working person in England, isn't it? I mean, that's a very substantial. The word fine isn't being used. But what she's being required to pay, very substantial.
Exactly, and it's a fine in another way. And now she is considering appeal, but is faced with the prospect of, in trying to defend herself, the risk of prosecution costs as she seeks to defend her liberty will increase as it goes through the superior courts. And so what the UK has done is pass primary legislation that creates huge powers to local councils to pass, in my opinion, extraordinary laws that, and people can look it up, literally refers to crossing oneself, praying audibly, genuflecting, and sprinkling holy water. They've allowed councils to pass these prohibitions, and then they have made it very difficult for citizens to defend themselves without risking bankruptcy.
I note from the actual opinion of the Magistrates Court judge that the prosecution authorities had petitioned the court convicting Ms. Tosici-Polk for something like £60,000, which would be about $80,000. And that would be enough to bankrupt someone, an ordinary person in England, I take it. I mean, these are very, very substantial penalties. I take it she was also, in the English phrase, bound over not to commit a similar offense. What are the implications of that?
It just places a restriction on her behavior now that means that if she is to be found doing the same thing again, that the penalties will start to significantly increase. So she's essentially it's like a stay of execution, essentially. So as long as she doesn't continue to act in this way, then this crippling fine will be the end of it. But if she does anything in the future that the court considers the same or similar, then she could face increasing penalties. And so,
could that include prison?
Not for the original offense, but if you then start to breach court orders, then that can be attract prison sentences. And so, but the real censorial component to these laws at the council level, not at the national level, but at the council level, is the crippling fines that the courts have now started to introduce. When these are people who, one of the discussion points in the UK is that essentially what's happening is people are out there harassing women, that they're causing all sorts of disturbances. And that's just not the case. Studies have shown that that's not been happening. It's a manufactured claim. And even if it was the case, there is pre-existing legislation within a UK context that would deal with it. And so what we've seen at ADF is people who feel very passionately about this issue, that volunteer their time to just stand as a silent witness, to offer consensual conversation, to pray silently. And these are the people that the police are going after and prosecuting. We've not had at ADF one single case so far of someone who is engaging in anything that would remotely be considered harassment by anyone's definition of the term. And so there's been essentially a manufactured problem here at the hands of those who want to silence these people claiming that all of this behavior is going on. And it's just not been happening.
Is there an avenue for appeal of the case?
There is. And so in both Adam Smith Connor's case and Livia's case, both of these can be appealed. Adam's case is being appealed. And it will go to the Crown Court and will be retried again at a more senior court.
You mentioned Adam Smith Connor, and indeed Vice President Vance mentioned Adam Smith Connor by name in the Munich speech. What was that case about?
So very similar to Livia's, Adam Smith Connor had an abortion many years ago, he and his girlfriend then, and it's a decision that he deeply regrets. He subsequently converted to Catholicism and made it part of his practice to pray for the unborn, including his deceased unborn child, and he was stood silently praying in the vicinity of one of these abortion centers, and the police approached him, and it's on camera with the police asking him what he is praying about, silently, that is. So he was stood silently, and on camera, the police are asking essentially about the thoughts in his head, about the things that's taking place in his head. And his honest answer to that question was the basis for the prosecution. He was also found guilty of breaching one of these PSPOs, and his case is being appealed this summer.
How did the police know he was praying?
Well, he is known to the abortion center, and he had, when these laws were passed, he had given notice to say he has no intention of breaching the law, but essentially said that this he will continue his practice. And so he, in his mind, was just seeking to obey the law but continue his witness. But in doing that, drew the attention of the center, of the police, who then, as they did in some of these other cases, found him, interrogated him, and ultimately saw his prosecution. I think that it's... What we're seeing with these pro-life cases in the UK is part of a much broader pattern that we're seeing in the UK and across the West, which I think is what Vice President Vance was referring to in his Munich speech, which is that all of these countries share the sense of Western civilization, this history, this common history, culture, and to a large degree, law, particularly between the UK and the US. And what seems to be happening right now is a transatlantic divide, where on the US side, there's been a recommitment towards freedom of speech from the administration in the last 9 months. And in the UK and across the EU, we seem to be moving in the exact opposite direction, doubling down on censorship. And so these cases of Adam, of Livia, of Isabel von Spruce and others are part of a bigger picture, I think, in Western Europe of a real retreat against freedom of speech and towards censorship.
Are these prosecutions, religious prosecutions, are they characteristic of prosecutions of all religions? Or is there, I mean, what American lawyers and viewers might not be familiar with the phrase two-tier, but it's a common phrase in Britain. And the idea is that the enforcement of even of the censorship policies are highly not neutral and highly not non-discriminatory as between different religions. Is that what you are finding in ADF as you look at these cases?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason for that is because these laws are so broad, they're so vaguely worded, that they convey upon those in power huge power to interpret the law as they wish. The police themselves have huge discretionary power in what they investigate and what they pursue. And so when you have such vaguely worded legislation, it creates a very clear opportunity for arbitrary enforcement. And that arbitrary enforcement essentially aligns politically with whatever the cultural and political orthodoxies of the day are. And so where there are groups that those in power may want to go after, and there are other groups that those in power may want to avoid if at all possible. And so you end up with what's being referred increasingly in the UK to two-tier policing, where you see this asymmetric enforcement of the law against different groups within society.
Well, to be clear, what groups are we talking about?
Well, you've got the, obviously there's an array of cases that we work on involving Christians who are being censored and silenced for their views that go against the cultural orthodoxies on life, as we see in Livia and Adam's case, and also in regard to sexual ethics, which is very different to the political cultural view of these issues today. But we know that there are other religious groups, obviously Muslims, Jews, who would share not the same, but would also have sexual ethic that never seems to clash with the law. I would struggle to think of a case, in fact, in the UK context where we've seen that sort of thing happen. But there are dozens and dozens of dozens of cases involving Christians.
There has been an ongoing scandal over the course of the last decade or more of what were euphemistically called grooming gangs involving sexual, essentially rape of young children across the country, largely, if not exclusively, by people in Britain of Pakistani origin and Muslims. And I take it the scandal has been how little was done to prosecute or to investigate or even to make known what the authorities knew was going on over the course of quite a few years. Is that the contrast that you're talking about between the two-tier enforcement against Christians on the one hand and against migrants and Muslims on the other?
Yeah, it's one of the examples. I mean, there are honestly many, many different examples that we could cite in lots of different areas. One of the examples within the free speech space in particular is in regard to protests regarding Israel and Gaza at the moment. And so what we've, and that's probably, I would say in the UK context, the clearest example of the two-tier policing within the speech issue, because you have, at the same time people being arrested for silent prayer, others are holding up what many would consider to be incitements to violence, incitements to genocide, that are being given a free pass and being told that that's free speech, that's democracy. And so the public is very aware of this arbitrary enforcement. It's increasingly fractious within a UK context to see, on the one hand, someone holding up a banner calling for the death of people, and on the other hand, someone being prosecuted, in our case, for holding up a sign saying, "Here to talk if you want." And so many other examples as well, but these particular ones in the last 9 months have been where it's been most clear.
Beyond the religious context, there's increasing concern, I think, in England about, and it was expressed in Vice President Vance's speech, about freedom of speech and freedom of expression much more generally. Tell us a little bit about that. There are a variety of laws. A prominent one is the Communications Act 2003, which gives grounds for arrest, as I understand it, for communications causing annoyance, inconvenience, or needless anxiety. The question to you essentially is, how are these laws being enforced? At what scale? To what extent are people being arrested or having police encounters over postings, social media postings, and so on?
Maybe I could take a step back and give a very brief sort of legislative history. I think it would put it in context. I won't bore everyone with all of the details, but I think it's worth pointing out that what we've seen in the UK and across other Western European nations over the last few years has not been a politically left or politically right issue as such. Now, in the UK, Tony Blair's government from 1997 onwards brought in a very clear left-wing government, and with that came certain pieces of legislation that started to restrict speech. But then we had a Conservative government from 2010 onwards, up until the very recent present, who just carried on with that trend. And I would say that you could put the last 25 years of British legislative history into three broad categories with regard to speech. So one would be wave after wave after wave of terrorism legislation, which Blair started in the War on Terror in 2000 and continues through to the present day. Most people would not associate terrorism legislation with a free speech issue, but the challenge becomes, once you extend police powers to the extent that our terrorism acts did, if you then start to loosen up and wiggle free the definition of terrorism and start to extend that definition to lots of different types of activity, then all of a sudden this legislation that no one thought would ever apply to them might start to become relevant. So that's one category. Another category of laws that we've passed for the last 25 years is various nondescript policing, crime, justice, courts acts. So every couple of years, it seems, there's a new policing act, and every single act amends previous ones, gives more discretion to the police and more powers, increases sentences in all of these different areas, and starts to introduce things like the public space protection orders and so forth. And then the third category of legislation is sort of standalone speech acts, like the Communications Act in 2003. We had the Racial and Religious Hatred Act in 2006, which criminalized stirring up hatred. We had the Online Safety Act passed just last year, and so forth. And so you add all of this together, and you've got potentially about at least 20 standalone pieces of primary legislation over a 25-year history, each one of which adds a little bit of criminal law to restrict freedom of speech. And what we're seeing now is a lot of the fruits of all of that. As I say, a lot of this happened in relatively nondescript legislation that Conservative governments were passing. And like with all of these things, no one ever thinks it's going to apply to them. And now what we're seeing, and it's being reported increasingly in the media, social media, is police turning up at people's doors, asking them about the tweets that they send, asking them about the Facebook posts that they put online and so forth. And everyone's wondering how on earth this has happened in a country like the UK. And the short answer is it's been happening for a quarter of a century, and we're only now just starting to see the extent to which it's being enforced.
What's this? Give a sense of the scale of this. Are these a handful of police encounters and a handful of prosecutions across the country, or are we talking about very significant numbers of police encounters? In other words, police coming to people's door, often armed police, handcuffing the homeowner or the home resident in front of their children very often, in numbers along the lines of many a day and thousands a year. I mean, yeah. Are we talking about something idiosyncratic, or are we talking about something that's become very widespread?
The front page of The Economist here, see if we get this in focus here, Europe's free speech problem. I think my blurring is limiting the ability to see it. But The Economist front page last week talks about this issue, and The Economist reports that 30 people a day are being arrested for things that they might have posted online. So in the context of a country like the UK, 60 or so million, it's a huge number. And I don't think that we have the full numbers yet accessible. We don't have the data. And that doesn't take into account all the other touch points that might take place with the police that fall short of that. Now, The Economist's view, which is one I share, is that in part, this is not happening because of a top-down desire to censor the population necessarily, although I do think there's a component of that. But it in large part comes to the broad powers that have been given to the police through all of this different legislation I mentioned over the last quarter of a century, and the obvious fact that the police have decided that they're going to become the police of what people tweet, what they say. And then The Economist says it's far easier to go after people for what they've posted online than the hard work of investigating real crimes. And it certainly, as a Brit, feels like the police have completely lost focus in the last few years. There's more and more reports that petty theft and other things just goes completely unreported. And at the same time, they're turning up on your doorstep, policing your views and what you say and all the rest of it in increasing number. Also, I'd say that one area that falls outside of crime, but it's still very significant, is something that was introduced by the police in 2011, again, under Conservative government. And it was the introduction of what they refer to as a non-crime hate incident. And a non-crime hate incident is not a crime, as the name suggests, but subjectively, according to the perception of the person who saw it, heard it, or was impacted by it, it was something hateful. And the police will record that based on the subjective perception of someone else. And then it will get entered onto a record that is held against you that can be checked by future employers in terms of background checks and that sort of thing. And there have been thousands of non-crime hate incidents recorded by the police over the last few years for some of the most ludicrous forms of speech.
So what are the implications for a person? Suppose someone complains about something that we say on this webinar, and the police enter it, as it happens in the UK, and the police enter it as a non-crime hate incident. What are the implications for me as the person who has been put on this register? Can this affect my getting a job? Can this affect my public employment? Can this affect other things? I mean, what are the consequences of this?
Yeah, so it can get put on your record, and you might not know that has happened. And then within the ability of different employers and others to do background checks, it will then get flagged within those background checks that might happen in the future. And so this happened to a former policeman, Harry Miller, who found out that he had been had a non-crime hate incident against him for a poem, a sort of satirical poem that he posted that led to a non-crime hate incident reporting. And he took this to court, challenged it. We supported his case. It went up to the Court of Appeal in the UK, the second highest court, who found that the whole system of non-crime hate incidents was totally inadequate, lacked checks and balances, and so forth, and told the College of Policing to change the process, but not necessarily to scrap it completely. So then they went away and sort of said that they learned from their lessons and what have you. And that happened 2 or 3 years ago. And I think from what we can tell in what's reported, there's been no indication of any meaningful change to the system, which means we're still living in the context where we can have these things labeled against us with potentially without even knowing.
For an American audience, the police in the United States are highly decentralized. In other words, at least until now, policing has been a state and, as a practical matter, a local matter. There are thousands or tens of thousands of police jurisdictions. The police are supervised, at least in the first instance, by locally elected officials. Is the police organization in Britain different in a way and more centralized in a way which caters to the development of this kind of trend in Britain that would be less likely in the U.S. to happen on a kind of uniform basis across the country?
It's probably a mixture in the U.K. And so we do have local decentralized police forces, but the standard of policing is, and the guidance, the police guidance that governs all of these different things, is held centrally. And we don't have the same system of the US where all of these local positions are directly elected. And so we have essentially centralized policing standards. Obviously, central legislation that they are enforcing. And then what is decentralized is the local forces themselves and some of the policy decisions that those forces make. And so we have seen over the years that some police forces are far more zealous than others in some of this. We see the same sorts of cases crop up in the same sorts of regions for a reason. But a lot of the guidance that they receive is handed down centrally. And certainly this, the non-crime hate incident framework is a national framework. And it's just applied at a local level within the different police forces.
I mean, to be clear, all police in England are answerable ultimately to the Home Secretary, in other words, to a national cabinet minister. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what's known in England as the Met, the London Metropolitan Police. The indications are that it receives about something more than 25% of all police funding in the UK. So the Met has jurisdiction outside London as well as complete police jurisdiction in London. So that essentially what the Met from London and a very few other police department, Manchester Police, and a very few others in England do, is massively more influential over how the police are going to conduct themselves across the country than any one police force in the U.S. Is going to have over what police do across America. Is that a fair assessment of what's going on?
Yeah, that's a good summary.
I guess we're coming to the end, and we have a few questions from the participants from the audience, which we'll turn to in just a second. I guess I'd like for us to wrap up with this somewhat broader question. Britain used to have a well-earned reputation for liberty and for British people being free to speak their minds. To the extent that these freedoms are now more and more constrained, and possibly, at least in some contexts and on some issues, disappearing entirely. What accounts for this? How has British society changed to account for what seems to be a growing loss of freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of thought?
I suppose for me as a Brit, that's one of the ultimate questions I find myself asking. And I don't think there's one quick, simple answer to that question. I'll give you a couple of different thoughts. Firstly, it seems to me that once this sort of domino effect of passing more and more censorial legislation began with the Blair government in the late 90s, it has created a domino effect, in my opinion, where whoever's in power thinks that one of the things that they have to do when they get in power is start passing some new piece of legislation that greater restricts liberty. Now, I don't know what the driving force for that is, especially given that we had 14 years of a conservative government who, when these people are not in government, are always talking about liberty and freedom and so forth. But it seems to be, and one of the things that I wrote about in the book Censored is that once this sort of shrinking dictionary begins, there's no real logical stopping point. It creates a life of its own. And that sounds so strange to describe, because I know I'm not describing what's driving that, other than it almost feels like it's a self-contained phenomenon. We see it in other countries too, for example, Germany, where there is this sort of censorial drive within Germany to, once they go down this route, to ban more and more and more speech. The same thing in the UK and other countries as well. Australia, Canada now following suit. I think that, speaking of Australia, one thing that a premier said in Australia just a few weeks ago, very openly, is the impact of the different cultures living within Australia, the impact that that then has on some of these issues. And the implication of what he was saying is that where so many different people are living together from so many different backgrounds and worldviews, in order to keep social harmony, in order to keep the peace, in order to essentially keep everyone not fighting with each other, then we have to restrict speech that could aggravate other groups. Now, this is certainly something that politicians had not been admitting until recently, but now they're starting, I think, to do so. And that's why, for example, when riots took place in the UK regarding the Southport killings last year, the clampdown on freedom of speech that followed that was immense. And I think, therefore, there's a relationship between the fragmented societies that we now have in many Western countries for lots of reasons, the low trust societies that we now have, and the greater increase that goes along with that of censorship to keep everyone in order and to keep a lid on what could otherwise spill over into societal tensions. And to bring this full circle, I think that's why Vice President Vance connected the issue of national security with freedom of speech, because these two things have become related. And I think what Vice President Vance was saying is, it's a very dangerous thing to not trust your people and to believe that if you give your people freedom of speech, that that's going to be the issue. And that's the lie that Germany's brought, that the UK has brought, and other Western nations, that we can't be trusted with this freedom of speech, and therefore it needs to be taken away from everyone.
Is it fair to worry, in a sense, that whereas the US has a history of assimilating immigrants and assimilating people from very different backgrounds, from very different origins, very different ethnicities, to some extent, very different races. Many other countries, including Western European countries and culturally Western European countries, like in a sense Canada and Australia, but certainly Western European countries, who have a history until very recently of being much more homogeneous, and no history at all of assimilating and sort of Americanizing or Germanizing, Francizing large numbers of migrants and immigrants from very different cultures. Countries other than the U.S. are newly diverse, newly heterogeneous, and maybe confronting these free speech questions much more acutely, even than the U.S. is doing, in times now and in times to come.
I think that's absolutely right. And they're doing it at the same time as not having the long history of the First Amendment protection and how that has sort of become part of the culture and part of the law as well. People talk generally about common law protections to freedom of speech in the UK and civil law protections in other European countries. But the reality is none of these countries have the judicial or legislative or cultural protection of freedom of speech that matches the US. So you have this twin issue. You don't have the history in the US. So you do have the history in the US of both assimilation and a recognition of freedom of speech. And we essentially in Europe have neither track record. And now we're facing these issues in a very heavy-handed way, and in a way that I believe will be very counterproductive to whatever aim they are pursuing.
It's liable also to impose even more of a wedge between the United States and Europe, in the sense that Vice President Vance teared in his speech, isn't it? The theme of his speech is if you in Europe expect the United States to pick up a very substantial tab for your defense, that's going to be more compatible with the American voter. So long as the civil and political values of your countries and of ours remain pretty much in sync, and to the extent that they are violently diverging, there's going to be that's going to have implications for defense and security relationships as well.
Yeah, this is a very challenging time for that reason. But also let's think positively about a great opportunity here. And perhaps this newfound free speech diplomacy from the US, which we had not seen in the previous 4 years, quite the contrary. Let's see if this has a positive impact on the UK and other EU nations in the next couple of years.
Let me put a couple of questions to you from our online participants. Question number one from an anonymous attendee. Without the First Amendment in the UK, can you educate us on any comparable fundamental laws in the UK governing or protecting free speech, free exercise of religion, etc.?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the UK and all other European countries are signatories to the European Convention on Human Rights. The European Convention on Human Rights protects freedom of speech, freedom of expression in Article 10. And then the UK incorporated this international convention into its national legislation through the Human Rights Act in 1998. And so our equivalent to the First Amendment is Article 10 of the Human Rights Act or Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And if you look at the wording of Article 10 and compare it to the First Amendment, it's similar enough that we should have the protections that we need under this legislation. The problem is how these things are interpreted. And the US has, I would say, got about 100-year history of progressively interpreting the First Amendment in a increasingly protective of speech way, starting around about 100 years ago, but certainly by the middle of the last century, you have one Supreme Court precedent after another giving greater protection to speech under the First Amendment. What we have in the UK and other European countries is we do not have that long history. And so these free speech provisions were incorporated into our national laws relatively recently, and therefore they've all been interpreted in line with all of this other context I've been given. In other words, they've been interpreted in a restrictive way rather than in the US an expansive way. So what I say to my US colleagues is it's not necessarily the First Amendment that has made the US special. It's the US Supreme Court's consistent interpretation of the First Amendment over a long period of time. And we do not have that in Europe.
A more specific question from Ricardo Parsi. Is there a mechanism for someone in the UK to verify if his records include a so-called non-crime hate incident?
I'm going to check that and I'll answer it in a second. Ask me another question. I'll have the answer for that one.
Here's a broader one from Jeffrey Wood. As an American lawyer and solicitor of England and Wales, whose first European ancestor in the US was William Brewster, a separatist pilgrim imprisoned for his religious beliefs. Perhaps the Crown Prosecution Service might be regressing to its mean. Weak ideas brook no dissent, which demonstrates the flaccidity of the reasoning underpinning these laws. How do you react to that?
I don't know. I think that the UK, the regression of the UK in this area is relatively recent. I mean, really, we're talking my adult lifetime. And so it's hard for me to jump too much to the conclusion that what we're seeing here is part of the, you know, the collapse of a nation that has a 1,000-year consecutive history and so forth. I mean, it might be part of a bigger thing in regard to the collapse of the UK and Western civilization in general. But I want to step back from the ledge and just think, well, I also remember life in the 90s that did not have the entire litany of legislation I just talked about and the sorts of cases that we've just talked about. So as a Brit that can trace history back over 1,000 years, I personally refuse to accept that the collapse of the country is going to happen in my adult lifetime, and therefore want to believe that any regression that we're experiencing right now can't be undone, even if it takes far longer to bring back than it took to collapse.
What specific steps would you like believers and supporters of civil liberty to take in Britain with a practical prospect of reviving greater freedom of religion, of expression, of speech in Britain that have, as you put it, come under challenge and under threat and under a policy of diminishing it in quite recent years? Concretely, what steps would you like advocates to take?
I think that because I emphasized throughout this that neither of the main two political parties in the UK proved to be champions of freedom of speech when they're in power, one of the first things that people need to do concretely in the UK is align their voting to those who are going to defend their freedom. And if that's not going to be found in the main two parties, then to consider alternatives. But as long as people keep voting for parties that as soon as they come into power, they start to restrict their freedom, then we can expect this sort of thing to happen. For example, the Conservative Party under Theresa May, one of her flagship pieces of legislation that she was desperate to push through was an extremism bill. She wanted to ban extremism and never defined what extremism was. And so if this is the thing that people are voting for, then this same sort of stuff is going to happen. So we have to align our voting to people who defend their freedom. And then the two other concrete areas, three other concrete areas of clear policy action that could be taken in the UK. One would be an omnibus free speech bill that doesn't just look at Section 127 of the Communications Act or these other public space protection orders or whatever else they might be, but we address all of them in one big free speech bill and find political champions for such a thing. Thirdly, we have to look at the discretionary powers given to the police in investigating all of these different things, which has to be reined in. And then fourthly, we have to find a way for citizens to be able to defend their freedom without it being so cost prohibitive, as we found in the case of Adam Smith Connor and Livia Tsitsipas. So if we got political support free speech, an omnibus free speech bill, reined in the powers of the police, and made people defending their freedom far more affordable, then I think we could see a huge change in this area in a relatively short period of time, because the British sentiment and spirit is still in favor of freedom, of liberty, of freedom of speech.
An ambitious agenda, but it seems to me a possible one. And something of an optimistic one, and an optimistic note, or at least a potentially realistic note on which to end. Many thanks to you, Paul Coleman.
Let me answer the question very briefly before we wrap up, which is to say that yes, if you are suspected of having a non-crime hate incident registered against you, you can find that out. You submit what is called a subject access request to the local police or other data privacy people in the UK, and you go through a whole procedure. Almost no one knows that this procedure exists. It's not easy to do. It takes time, but technically it should be possible. And maybe, Professor, you and I should do that after this call to see if anything has been lodged while we've been having this conversation.
I was about to speculate just precisely that let us hope that no one thinks ill of us and turns us over to the overbearing police policy of which we've seen worrisomely too much in these cases, very illuminatingly and very interestingly from you, Paul. So thanks to Paul Coleman. Thanks to Caroline and the organizers of the International and National Security Law Practice Group. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. And here's to a better prospect of freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of thought in our allied countries, as well as in our own country here. With that, Take care, everyone, and have a good and free rest of the day.
Thank you so much, Professor. And I just want to echo you and say, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of you all for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc. Stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.